Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. My name's Carl Shinneman, Director of Analytics and Review with Juranov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, whenever they want to download their iPod or listen on the computer. Today we have a very interesting show on backup tapes to help those who are not techies have a better sense of what it means if you agree with the other side maybe to go to backup tapes or you're just looking at them internally. We're going to talk about the pitfalls of backup tapes and how they can actually help you with e-discovery. It used to be that backup tapes were seen as tools which, when looked to, basically could end your career in e-discovery or cause great pain. The Zubelake and Coleman case also are really good examples of backup tape intensive cases. Today, the world is changing. Technology's gotten better, but the risks are still present. And we're going to use today's show to try to provide some insights into this area and turn backup tapes into English. The panel is great. First panel is Craig Ball, probably doesn't need an introduction. He's a prolific contributor to continuing legal and professional education programs throughout the United States and world. He's delivered over 600 presentations and papers. His articles on forensic technology and electronic discovery frequently appear in national media, including the American Bar Association, ALTA, and American Lawyer, print media, and online publications. He also writes a monthly column on computer forensics and e-discovery for Law Technology News called Ball in Your Court. He was honored in both 2007 and 2008 as a gold medal honoree's best regular column, as awarded by Trade Association Business Publications International. It's also the 2009 gold and 2007 silver medalist honoree of the American Society of Business Publication Editors as best contributed column, and their 2006 silver medalist honoree as best featured series and best contributed column. The presentation, Power Persuasion, Craig Ball on PowerPoint, is consistently among the top-rated continuing legal educational programs from coast to coast. Craig also did one of the first ESI Bytes podcasts, and it quickly became our top downloaded program when we used to rank the shows. Quinn Greger is Chief Operating Officer with Strategic Data Retention and has almost 30 years of data conversion and forensics, working in the oil industry, writing tape software for the discovery of oil and gas for 21 years. In the mid-90s, his software was processing and analyzing over 5,000 tapes a day, and he was worrying about how to manage 50 terabytes of new data on a daily basis for the world's largest oil company. Data management was a large part of the operations group he worked with, and he learned many valuable lessons that serve him well today. He's also a pioneer in the e-discovery field with backup tapes, having worked on backup tapes in both the Zubelake case and Morgan Stanley case. Quinn also did a really nice podcast with ESI Bytes on mismanaging ESI, and on a different note, helped me navigate Washington, D.C. during the Georgetown e-discovery conference. We were driving in the same car, and he pulled out a GPS system on his brand-new Droid PDA. I just would like to add that's not the way to navigate a city. It almost ended ESI Bytes for everyone with one poorly timed right turn here while I was in the middle lane.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Quinn. Anyway, and the last panelist, Jim McCann, is also a professional in the field of backup tapes. He's a vice president of information discovery with Index Engines. Jim has extensive experience with e-discovery and information management. He's currently contributing to the Sedona Working Group addressing electronic document retention and production. He also is a frequent speaker for industry organizations such as ARMA and ILTA, and has authored multiple articles for legal technology and information management publications. So with that in mind, like to always ask the first general question. I'll start with you, Jim. How did you first get interested in electronic discovery?
Well, that's actually interesting. We had Index Engines had technology that was able to, you know, make information discoverable, and we were working really within the storage market. And we were at a conference in New York, and a lawyer walked up to us, and we were like, well, "What does a lawyer have to do with storage?" And a couple of years back, and he said, "Can you help? You know, you have understanding of how to get data out of complex environments. Can you help me get data from backup tapes?" And we said, "Yeah, I mean, we can. What do you want to do that for? Backup tapes really don't serve a purpose after disaster recovery is done with their usefulness." And he's like, "Yeah, of course." And he explained the whole process of e-discovery, and this was many years ago. And we started working with them to get data off tape, and found that there was just a huge market that was just about to explode in e-discovery. a couple of years back, and that's how we really entered it. It was really kind of pulled in by a lawyer in New York.
Okay, and Craig, yourself, and then Quinn.
Well, I've really yet to develop an interest in e-discovery on that score, so I'll have to pass.
Okay, Quinn.
Now, I've been involved in discovery literally my entire career. So first it was oil and gas, and then when I moved to wonderful Atlanta, Georgia, with its thriving oil industry, I realized perhaps I ought to think about what else I'm going to do. And I was fortunate enough to be asked to join Emag Solutions, who at the time was a tape manufacturing company. And I brought the data restoration and electronic discovery to that company. I realized that they could reuse their skills and helped move that company from being a manufacturing to being the service provider it is today. So I've been doing this practically all my career, and my interest is evolving basically into different fields, still very heavily technology focused, but I've been doing tapes for almost 30 years now for my sins.
Okay, well, early in e-discovery, as we mentioned in the intro, backup tapes played a key role in some of the most significant cases. We mentioned Zubelake and Morgan Stanley or the Coleman case. Craig, today are backup tapes still an important part of e-discovery matters?
Well, they are, certainly, but it's an interesting change, because when you've had cases like Zubelake that opined that backup tapes were sort of epitomized the not reasonably accessible information, and you have the commentary and the so-called new rules that say much the same thing, we see a consistent effort to move away from backup tapes, and at the same time, technology has moved forward and made backup tapes really quite reasonably accessible compared to where things were even just 5 years ago. So backup tapes are still an important part of e-discovery. They're still one of the last bastions of places you can go to get the decisive information in cases when it's gone from almost every other quarter. But one thing I should add quickly is that the role of backup tapes themselves are changing in enterprises, such that you're seeing less of a reliance on backup tapes for disaster recovery and more use of backup tapes as the long-term storage medium or the archival medium. So that is affecting its use in e-discovery too, since we're now seeing it becoming the place where you go to get the information. That is to say, it's not something that is going away quickly, but is staying around as the long-term archive.
So as we bridge the gap from when backup tapes were considered a nightmare on backup tape sort of material, and now they're more strategic, Quinn, or can be, when should you absolutely want to be strategic and go to backup tapes to find ESI, which might be relevant to a case?
Well, if you look at a case and you say, well, where's the information likely to be? If it's a recent case, you know, the assumption can be made, hey, this information should be available online, so that should be no need to go to the tapes. But if you want to go back in time, say you want to look at, say, an employee who may have departed, or say it's 3, 6 months ago, a year ago, 2 years ago, you know there's going to be cleanup. So if you want a more complete picture or a more compelling picture just to figure out what's going on in your case, then absolutely you should look at tapes. If you've got the hardware in place, you've got the software, you've got the people, it's not a great expense. If, on the other hand, you don't have those in place, then you may want to reevaluate that decision. But tapes are by far a more preferable access medium than going to, say, a computer that has been reissued and forensically taking an image of that and trawling through that, looking for deleted file fragments and everything else. That's very expensive and very, very time-consuming. By comparison to going to a backup tape and pulling off just the files you want. If you think about what backup tapes are used for, they're used primarily for safety copies. You'll find the email there. You'll find, obviously, all the office attachments or office files and attachments that go through the email system. So backup tapes do present a very compelling picture as to what's going on. They really are best evidence.
Okay.
And should be really a first port of call.
Well, Well, Jim, I mean, sometimes you don't want to go to backup tapes, and from when should you fight to the death to say it really doesn't make sense to go to the trouble of reviewing backup tapes?
when you don't want to know the truth, I guess. No, I mean, as Quinn mentioned, I mean, it's a snapshot. It's a point-in-time snapshot of electronically ESI that's less tamper-proof versus online data. I mean, if you've got, a CEO of a company that's under investigation and email, related to email conversations and so on, I mean, it's easy to tamper with online data. I mean, backup tapes are a total snapshot that's kind of locked in a proprietary format. That's really the truth. Actually, what happened, you can roll back time with them. So we many lawyers are using the burden argument whenever they hear the words backup tapes because they assume it's going to be expensive. It's an unknown. They don't know what's on tape, and they may not want to know what's on those tapes. So, it's easy to present backup tapes as cost prohibitive and fight to the death that they don't want to go and produce content that's on there. So it really depends on what side of the case you're on. If you really want to know the truth, backup tapes are a great place to do that. And as far as cost, I mean, we get, cases or legal teams that are calling us to quote on what it costs to produce data from backup tapes, and they want to hear an answer of hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars, and it's not that expensive anymore. So I think, people want them to be inaccessible depending on what side of the case you're on.
Although it can, I guess, when the case is more focused and you get an overbroad request, it can add to an overbroad request in some instances.
Right.
I would imagine. I mean, you wouldn't always want to go to backup tapes is sort of what I was trying to get at. No,
not necessarily. But I mean, it's a good snapshot. We kind of look at them as a natural litigation hold. I mean, it's already locked down and off-site in storage and locked away. So it's a good place to get the accurate view of data at a point in time. But many people don't, just really fight to the death because it may not be information they want to get access to, or it may be expensive, or there's lots of data on tape, but it's highly redundant and there's a lot of garbage on there as well, so filtering through it is the challenge.
Okay. Craig, what's happened in backup technology in recent years that upends the conventional thinking, especially the burden calculation for backups and e-discovery, which Jim was just talking about?
Well, that's a great question, Carl. Thank you. Well, there's a lot that's happened in the landscape of backup tapes. It's kind of akin, if you think about it, to what's happened in the consumer photography world, whereas just a few years ago we were using film and there was a lot of cost associated with taking a picture and developing a picture and so forth. And today we don't really think about it with digital photography. I mean, you want to take 10 pictures, it doesn't cost any more than one. There's no development cost, et cetera. That movement to the digital format has dramatically changed consumer photography, and developments in backup tape similarly have made tape so much more accessible. Now, you've heard Quinn and Jim touch on some of those developments, but probably the most important thing of many important developments is that there's been the emergence of what might be called non-native or virtual restoration of backup tapes. In the old days, say 5 years ago and beyond, you would have had to take each tape or group of tapes, and then you would have had to restore it to a piece of physical hardware. And then it's almost like you've waved a magic wand and you've gone back in time and poof, there's your server or there's your machine. And then you would have had the next week or the next day or the next month and you would have restored that. And then you all of a sudden have all poof, 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 all of these machines of points in time popping up, each which is about 90% like the machine next to it, but 10% different, enough different that you still have to look at it and deal with the information. Today, however, you can use software to virtually or non-natively restore that information. You can use deduplication technologies so that you're processing only the differentials. And very importantly, it's now very easy, relatively quick, and relatively low cost to be able to take a glance into the backup tape to generate an index of individual content files and even to pull out individual files without doing a full-blown restoration. And so in a sense, backup tapes have gotten much more like disk. You can go in, you can search for just the things you need, and you can pull them out selectively, which is a dramatic change from where we were just a few years ago.
How do non-techies become comfortable about backup tapes? Say their process of being created, what's on them, their limitations, the importance of good storage, without getting thoroughly confused.
Okay, this is another good question. It's a tough one to answer if you think about tapes, but if you think about applicable analogies, and I have a few, then I think you can wrap your head around it. Most of our listeners went to school to study law, and they have no idea what happens in a computer room or an operations department or these days increasingly in the cloud. And so the most time, yeah, they have no need to. So when tapes present themselves, you may want to think about what a backup tape is and how it's used, and then think back in time before we had DVDs and content on demand. Back to the days when we had a videotape. Videotape technology, it's very similar and in some cases almost identical. To access a tape, whether it be a movie or whether you want to find data, you need to know if you have the right tape and whether or not your VCR was compatible. Say you had an 8mm home movie tape. You couldn't play that in a regular VCR. You'd have needed a special adapter. And if your tape was too old, then it would start to decay, and when you played it back, the picture quality would be terrible because the information was corrupted or missing, as maybe parts of the tape had actually fallen off. And if the tape had been dropped or stored in the heat or gotten wet or too dry, then it would likely be damaged. And likewise, say your kids put a cookie inside the VCR, or you know, didn't clean your VCR, then the tape may get stuck in the drive. Sometimes the box the tape came in said one thing, and the tape contained something else, or was empty, or was blank. And sometimes you only had tape 2, and you were missing tape 1. You know, all the challenges you face with your VCR, these are the same that computer operations department faces when it's trying to restore tapes. You know, you have to have the correct number of tapes. You need to know which order to read them in. You have to have a tape drive that understands or is compatible with the tape. And even if the tape can be placed into the drive, and going back to the VCR analogy, if the tape... Hold on, please. If the tape... be placed in a VCR. If the tape was recorded, say, in the Super VHS, you can't read it in a VHS player. So in computer terms, if you don't understand the tape format, then unless you have a special tape software, you'll not be able to read the tape. So another way to think about tape is more fun. It's to imagine it's a bottle of wine. A bottle doesn't like to be dropped. It has to be carefully stored at the correct humidity and light levels, or you'll ruin the contents. It has a shelf life, and after a certain amount of time, the contents start to go bad. The label doesn't describe the quality of the contents. So if the label is missing, try and guess the year and the vintage and the varietal just by holding it and not accessing it. And that's a challenge, to say the least. I could go on, but if you're trying to wrap your head around tapes, think about VCRs and wine, and that's a great place to start.
Can I add something to that?
Sure.
Quick? And it, at the risk of being thought a shameless plug, I wrote a paper about what lawyers need to know about backup tapes that Quinn and I presented at the recent Georgetown conference. And so if someone is interested in looking for a lawyer's primer for backup tape technology, they can find one at my website, which is craigball.com, craigball.com, and it'll be on the left side of the website as a backup tape technology primer.
Well, those were good descriptions, and that was actually a great presentation. It gave me the idea for doing this podcast. I'd just like to add, you had me with the videotapes. I'm thinking of my old Disney movies and Christmas videos on different mediums. The wine, I drink my wine. I don't store it. So, but anyway, Jim, you know.
You just need more.
Jim, who should do backup tape restoration? You know, is this something that can go in-house for the IT staff, or is this really almost always an outside vendor's domain?
Well, it really depends on what you're talking about. We look at it in two ways with tape. We look at, you know, reactive litigation support, you know, getting data from a known set of tapes, you know, on litigation hold to support a case. That's typically done by outside vendors. And that's due to the, you know, tight time frames. You know, it's a lot of hurry up and wait, and then when it's the data is necessary or required for the courts or for you know, meet and confer, the deadlines are very tight. So there's a lot of vendors out there that can process tapes very effectively and very quickly. And it's typically a smaller number of tapes. The other way we look at it is really proactive litigation readiness. Is we have a number of our customers that are getting rid of tapes. You know, a lot of these old legacy tapes, and it's 20,000 tapes or 50,000 tapes. We have customers with hundreds of thousands of tapes that have really just stockpiled out there. It's a process of proactively processing tapes to get the relevant data off and deliver the content to an archive, a records management platform, a litigation hold. And then this should really be done in-house to make it cost-effective. I mean, as a service, it becomes a little bit pricey in that volume range. So it's really something that IT really needs to solve that problem. And remediating tens of thousands of tapes at their leisure, rather than facing the expensive reactive fire drill, is definitely done in-house. And these clients know they will have to produce this content someday. And many of our clients are, you know, Fortune 200 clients that are under a lot of litigation, and they know that data is a liability. And if it's not currently a litigation hold, they can define a policy that allows them to eliminate it. They just need to understand where it is, what it is, get it off of that proprietary format, and get it into their platforms. And doing that in-house is definitely mandatory because the volume's larger. It's also very sensitive data that they may not want to send outside, and they don't want to be paying a fee for each tape to be processed. So we look at it as reactive, really being done through service partners, and the proactive litigation readiness being done in-house by IT.
But there is, if I might add to what Jim has just said, there is something that has to be considered in the context of e-discovery, whereas he's described in a process of assimilating over time the contents of vast encyclopedia of tapes. In e-discovery, we often have a 30, maybe a 60-day window to get the information off and processed. And, of course, getting it off the tape is only a very early step in the processing of e-discovery. Using an outside vendor allows you to do something that's called going wide. In-house, you're set up with your infrastructure, with your tape drives, to be able to process what you need for disaster recovery. But when you need to get information off vast volumes of tape, one of the things a vendor can provide is the ability to have lots of parallel processing platforms so that they can get the information off the tapes by going wide, by having all these side-by-side platforms to pull the information off, whereas most in-house operations don't have the ability to go into a closet and pull out 100 backup tape drives to develop that information.
Quinn, Craig touched on this a little bit on duplication of ESI on backup tapes. Do you have anything you want to add about how much duplication you can expect and what you can do about it?
Yeah, I thought about this answer, and I've got I'll break it down, make sure everyone can understand it. So as both Jim and myself have said, a backup is a snapshot in time. Typically, a backup represents a copy of what existed on the systems when they were backed up. So if you're just restoring one set of backup tapes, you're going to come across files that are identical, that are stored across numerous different locations within that one file system. So, for example, say a planning document was created internally, and then it was sent via email to a number of different people, and a number of those people saved it to disk. So the backup occurs, and when you're restoring the backup, you'll have the original document, and then you'll have all the copies of that in the email system, and then you'll have the various saved copies. So compare that. If you're restoring tapes across many dates, as Craig was just describing, you're going to find these same files on tape after tape after tape, and in reality, you only need one copy. So depending on the number of backups and their type and how close in time they are to each other, you could have easily 80 to 90% duplication of content, or even higher. If you're looking at a full backup that was made on Monday, and for some reason the operations department did a full backup on the next day, then there's going to be very, very little new content. So what do you do about this? You've got high duplication. There's a process called deduplication most of us have heard about, and that involves reading the file and determining the contents and assigning a mathematical numbers to the content through a process called hashing. You'll hear people talk about MD5 and SHA-1 hashes. You know, these are common hashing algorithms. MD5 is the most widely adopted at this stage. It's being replaced by SHA or secure hashing algorithm. It's more advanced. It has a greater degree of accuracy. So you'll hear both being referenced, and other, you know, various vendors will talk about one versus the other. You know, regardless of the system, the process is the same. Files with the same hash value are assumed to be identical, and only one copy is needed for review purposes. So depending on the review approach being taken, you may decide to keep one copy of the file per person or just one copy for the entire collection. Regardless of what's decided, when deduplicating, it's important you maintain a trail of who originally had what files, because if something interesting crops up, and if you performed a global deduplication, then you need to know who else had a copy of that information. Again, with tapes, very high levels of duplication, so you need to think about other approaches to deduplication, and an evolving one that's been around for a couple of years now, it's becoming more popular, is called near deduplication. This is, again, where we use hashing methodology. Files that are similar but not identical can be classified as near duplicates. So when you're dealing with email, this is very common, where an email chain will contain the same emails appended with the appended content. So a near deduplication strategy will collapse that email thread so only the most complete part of the thread is preserved. So if you're reading lots of tapes across numerous date ranges, near duplication is a great way to drastically reduce the document population.
Craig,
can I add one piece there? Quinn, also the issue of tape data, you're also dealing with a lot of useless files, and there's a terminology known as denisting. There's a lot of data that the National Institute of Standards has determined as, you know, like system file data, like help files that are commonly found in backup tapes. So, you know, as Quinn mentioned, there's a significant volume of duplicate data on tape, but there's also a significant volume of just useless computer files that are not user-generated data. And, you know, technology can dedupe and denest very effectively, and it just makes the job a lot easier.
Okay. Craig, do different types of backup tape procedures impact how you use backup tapes in eDiscovery?
Yes, and this is really the time that I would want to offer something of a cautionary note. We've been trying to simplify so much of this in our discussions that it would be very easy for a listener to think that backup tapes are just like their VCR tapes in the sense that, well, okay, you want to watch Caddyshack, you go get your copy of Caddyshack and you plug it in. I guess I'm telling you how old I am when I pick that movie. You plug it in, you watch the movie. But it's really more akin to imagining that your favorite movie resided over 20 or 30, maybe, backup tapes or VHS tapes. And, oh, by the way, the scenes are split and jumbled across all the different tapes. So unless you know exactly how they are laid down, and unless you play the tapes through and then re-edit the movie on the fly, you're not going to see what you're expecting. That's an important qualifier, because backup tapes are not built around eDiscovery. They're built around optimizing for restoration in the event of disaster recovery. As a consequence of that, you have to realize that the tapes will be iterative, which is to say that you may have information written according to only that which has changed since the last backup, or it may be written down not according to what the file says or what the file is called, but based upon some other purely technical criteria that makes it easier to pack more information onto the tape. The information may be encrypted or almost certainly will be. It will be compressed or, again, optimized so that you can get pack more information on the tape. And so it's very important for a lawyer to not make assumptions about what the backup tape will be, but instead to go to the IT people who are knowledgeable, get them to explain the backup indexing system, the backup logging system that keeps track of where the information is, how it's split out on various tapes. It's important to think of these tapes as more like a volume of encyclopedias rather than a single book. And again, that information may not be in a logical or at least a human-readable logical way. So while we've been talking about how much easier backup tapes have become, and they have, we still don't want to equate that increased ease with effortlessness. Backup tapes are still somewhat complicated, and so it's important that you learn the particular system that is in use at the enterprise or at the client, because almost every implementation is somewhat unique. Even the software that they use and very likely the media, that is to say the types of tapes that they use, will vary. And even within an organization, they will almost certainly vary over time. As tapes have grown in capacity, as new technologies have emerged, it would be very unlikely for a company today to be using the same backup media or software that they used 5 or 10 years ago.
Jim, do you get everything back when you go to a backup tape? I mean, what do you get? You know, we're thinking about metadata, finding deleted files, these types of things.
Yeah, I mean, as Craig mentioned, there's lots of different backup software that's used to create backups. And basically what it does is it creates a container, a proprietary container. But, you know, IBM and EMC and Symantec and Computer Associates all have different flavors of these backup software. And what they do is they grab, you know, the loose files and email and the network, and they put it into this container and then take it offline onto tape. So really what tools do, such as ours, obviously, is we crack inside to that container and we pull the original content out, whether it be an email or a file. And during that process, what we need to do is be careful to create, hash algorithms and document signatures and so on to track to make sure that through that process the content does not change. So any technology that's any discovery that makes any modification to email or files is obviously not going to get very far. So it's really creating the trail through that extraction or the restoration process to make sure that everything is 100% accurate. We also, in our tool, I can't speak for others, is we have a record, or the index is actually the record of all the metadata. So if you want to reference, you know, what was the last access date or what was the last modify date or when it was deleted, all that information is on tape, and it's also in the index that's generated and can be referenced there. So all these tools really need to make sure that that data is not modified and it's exactly as it was to pull it out of those containers.
Great. I'm just going to make one note, Jim. I got a couple more questions for you. You've got a couple more opportunities to try to work some type of a character, be it the groundhog who's already been taken from Caddyshack and videos and Bambis and whatever, okay?
Well, you know, I had wine up my sleeve, but I knew Quinn was going to grab that one.
I'm just giving you warnings. It's like a 10-minute warning here, okay? Well, going back into the material here, Quinn, why do backup tapes break? And how common
okay,
is it?
Okay, that's not as common as it used to be. And that's how I got my start in the game years ago. It's rare these days. For a tape to snap, it really has to be incorrectly stored. If it's too dry or too moist, you start to get problems. If it's too moist, we used to see a process called hydrolysis or stiction. And this is where the surface of the tape would become a gummy mess because it absorbed too much moisture. And it would stick to the tape path and the heads, and eventually that stickiness would cause enough stress that it would grab the tape and the tape would stretch and eventually snap. And you'd have to take the tape drive apart, and it was horrible. So that's what we used to have. It's still an issue. If you have to go back to 9-track tape, that's the open reel tape, You will come across this. Fortunately, 9-track is old enough that we rarely have to process it these days. So we rarely come across it. I think another way to look at this, rather than say break, we should say, why do tapes fail? And again, this is related to storage, maintenance, and handling. So the environment in which the tape is stored has a big bearing on its long-term viability. If the tape is stored in a dusty environment, or say the tape's put down on a desk and the operator's been eating some food there, and the food sticks to the bottom of the tape, and the tape's then put in the tape drive, those food particles are going to come out, and eventually they'll find their way into the physical tape mechanism. They'll find their way into the tape path. And it may not be that tape. It may be another tape or another tape. But either way, you start to contaminate the system, and eventually things start to go wrong. The information on a tape is very, very densely packed. The tapes these days, typically, they start reading at one end of the tape. They get to the other end, and then the head moves down, and the tape starts to read in the other direction. And literally, this is called a serpentine read action. If you've got a blob of something in the middle of that tape, that's going to corrupt everything from that point in the tape forwards, at which point, basically, you've effectively lost that tape unless you're going to spend a lot of money to try and recover. Recovery is possible, but it's very, very expensive.
Craig, how long does it take to restore a backup tape?
Well, that's a great question too. I was laughing to myself because when you introduced Quinn, I think you said that he was restoring 5,000 tapes a day. So by that measure, I guess it would be a couple of hundred tapes an hour, or about 3.5 tapes a minute can be restored.
For the we'll go from professional to amateur. Okay, there's got to be a continuum here, right?
Quinn would be the first to say, I mean, he had to go incredibly wide with an amazing infrastructure to achieve that kind of thing. In point of fact,
we had a $200 million infrastructure with hundreds of tape drives. So yes, we did.
I mean, the thing that really distinguishes tape from disc media more than anything else is it's a mechanical process. And mechanical is the slowest thing in any kind of electronic mechanism. As a consequence of that, the tape has to go through the drive. And that's a process that is measured not in milliseconds or nanoseconds, but measured in hours. As a consequence of that, you have got to realize that you can't come in with 3,000 tapes on a Friday, and even in a fairly sophisticated vendor situation, they're going to be able to tell you what's on those tapes by Monday. The one law that lawyers can't find a loophole for is the law of physics. So this was recently looked at by the big Atlanta-based tape house, Quinn's former employer, EMAG Solutions, and they did a very useful study of how long it takes. And they found that really, even if you factor in the specifications for the tape and what should be the minimum data transfer time for tapes, that their performance, or all tape performance, I should say, not just theirs, is going to take about twice as long or longer than you would expect with a tape. So let's say an LTO2, which is a kind of older 200 gigabyte tape, they were expecting it to take something under 2 hours, but it actually took 6 hours per tape for them to pull the information off. Now, there are a lot of factors for this. Human beings having to swap in the tape and swap out the tape to keep track of exactly when the tape ended and pull it out and put a new tape in are one of the inefficiencies, but a lot of other things. Tape format, the particular interface that you're using, the level of compression of the data, how much does it need to be reconstituted like Tang before you can use the information, the number of devices that are competing for the data channel, just like when we're on a cable connection for the internet, if there are a lot of people sharing the connection, everything slows down, and then other things, the size of the data blocks. Even the file sizes themselves make a difference. If you're trying to catalog a tape and you have a million small files on it, it takes longer to catalog each of those tiny files than it would be to catalog one giant file. So all of this competes for and contributes to make the process relatively slow. So the one thing you do need with tape is time. And the more time you can give a vendor, the lower your cost. So you don't want to wait to day 28 on a 30-day response period to get the tapes in process. The very first thing you want to do when that e-discovery request comes in is assess, is tape going to be a source we must turn to, and get that tape in process for at least indexing and search immediately.
Jim, let's look at some of these legacy issues with backup tapes or older tapes. The ones you know, which were replicated every 2 weeks but still end up in a box and sit for years or longer. In today's world, you know, why do this? Is there any utility to be keeping these tapes? And if you want to get rid of them, how do you get rid of them?
Good question. So, I mean, you have to understand the IT disaster recovery policy. I mean, the reason tapes exist is for disaster recovery. If something happens to the networks in the company that a snapshot of the data as it was when it was last backed up can be reproduced or brought back online. So many IT organizations have this policy where these disaster recovery tapes are cycled through a 2-week or maybe a 30-day rotation. After that, IT doesn't know what to do with them. They're typically thrown over to, you know, offsite storage and put in a salt mine because they can't shred them because they don't know what's on them. They don't know is there evidence on there that needs to be maintained. I mean, so the fear of the unknown is really what keeps them about. And since many firms don't really have a strict policy in place on what to do with those tapes, IT just holds on to them and keeps them, and they really stockpile them. So it's really the fear, you know, the unknown. So if IT did not make that data discoverable and said, okay, they're no longer of use for disaster recovery, legally you need to tell me what I can keep, what I should keep, and what I shouldn't keep. And you can move it off tape as long as you keep it forensically sound. I mean, it doesn't have to remain on tape. And then that gives you the freedom to recycle that content. So it's really just the fear of the unknown that creates those stockpiles of tapes.
And how important is it having some type of catalog to a backup tape procedure?
Okay. This really depends on your budget and how quickly you'd like to restore the tapes. A catalog is an index stored centrally in a database on the computer that says what files exist on a tape and where they came from and where they should be restored to in the event the tape is read for disaster recovery purposes. Almost all conventional backup software insists on having a catalog so that it knows what files to restore. So if you're restoring a file using regular store-bought software or, you know, the big names that Jim was talking about, then it will, if it doesn't know about the tape, then it will want to import the tape and will read the entire tape and it will extract the metadata from the file headers and will use this to build the catalog, at which point the tape is accessible. But the challenge here is, and this is where most people struggle, is you have to have the correct version of the backup software, which has to be compatible not only with the tape, but your tape drive infrastructure. It can get very complicated. An approach which Craig was talking about earlier is greatly preferred to use what's called non-native restoration software. This is software that doesn't care about the catalog and that can directly read the tape and pull off the contents. The result of doing this is you get the entire contents of the tape restored, and then you have to deal with that high volume of data. You end up with lots and lots of disks stuffed with information, and you have to look through each one. That's a long, long process, but that's the way it was until even a couple of years ago. A more preferred non-native approach is a hybrid of these two, and that's what a couple of vendors now offer, and that is to read the tape non-natively using special software and to, again, as we talked about earlier, index the contents. So the index is an index not only of the metadata, you know, the file names, the file types, the dates, and so on, but it's also the words contained within those files. So now you have the ability via a GUI to search the index and determine the contents of the files while they're still on tape and then pick and choose specifically what you want to restore. This is far more effective than the other two methods and saves you considerable time and money if you're dealing with legacy or undocumented media.
Okay. Craig, given these changes, especially that latter method, we talk a lot about sampling and e-discovery. Is sampling still really important with backup tapes?
It's more important than it ever was before, and it's a much underutilized technology. Now, you've heard Jim talk about companies that, out of fear or other reasons, are keeping tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of tapes. And you've heard Quinn and I talk about the high level of duplication or identicality between tapes. So imagine you have hundreds of thousands of a thing, and much of them are identical, but still critical differences between them. Notwithstanding what Quinn just shared about backup tape catalogs, the fact of the matter is people have a very general idea at best of what is on individual tapes. They know that a particular group of tapes is a backup of, say, their mail server of a particular time. Hopefully they know that. But they don't have the information that we need in e-discovery at the granular level, at the level of, does a document contain a keyword? Would it be responsive to this Boolean search? And I think it's the rare case where you could afford to do a restoration of your universe of tapes to that granular level. As a consequence of that, what you want, just as you would want in your own life, is something of a biopsy on the data. You wouldn't let somebody take out a major organ system before they performed a biopsy and confirmed that it was cancerous. And in the same sense, you want the ability to dig down into a potentially responsive, likely candidate to contain responsive information e-discovery. You're going to pick some sets or bookend some intervals with backup tapes. You're going to take a look inside of those tapes. You're going to say, does this contain responsive information? And very importantly, what you're going to get from that is a level of reliable direction. It's going to give you some proven insight that you can carry to the court about the contents of your tapes. So now, instead of simply gesticulating wildly to the court, oh, it's going to be hard, Judge, you can say, Your Honor, we've sampled some tapes likely to be responsive for these custodians, for this interval, for this business unit. We've analyzed that data, and as a consequence, we can tell you it's going to take X number of hours to do it. And more importantly, we've made a reliable, proven calculation of the cost. And so we're no longer just telling you it's going to be hard or expensive. We can prove to you by sampling that it will be hard or expensive, and we can target our search so that we're not just simply going blindly through massive amounts of information, but we're using, based on sampling, a precise approach to get what we need and not bring up a lot of stuff we don't need.
Great, thanks. Jim, what's the future of backup tapes? Do you have any sort of future predictions here?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of backup tape out there. I mean, you have to look at the legacy tapes. I mean, we have clients that are not backing up the tape any longer because there's other ways that you can back up data. You can back up to disk. You can back up to other environments and not use tape, but they still have legacy tape environments. You know, if you've got five-year-old tapes that are sitting off-site, they tend to not address that, you know, when they're addressing this new backup environment. So I think, you know, backup tapes aren't going to go away. For many customers, it's still a very affordable, very inexpensive way. And the key thing is that the IT infrastructure is in place to disrupt that and to build a new backup infrastructure is very complex for, think about a Wall Street bank doing that. It's a big, big, massive change. So they're not going to go away. There's still a lot of legacy tapes there. But even if they're backing up to disk, they still have the issue of backing up into a proprietary backup format. You know, the backing up to a magnetic tape versus backing up to disk means it's still in that proprietary container. So it still makes it a little bit, some of the challenges are still there. But we see customers, we have many customers that don't back up the tape anymore but still have a lot of legacy tape. So I think it'll take a number of years for it to start to be remediated.
But Jim, haven't you already seen a lot of these customers dropping in what are called VTLs or virtual tape libraries, which are disk arrays that are meant actually to emulate the older disk technology, the older tape technology. So aren't we already seeing some movement away from tapes at that primary disaster recovery level?
Absolutely, yeah. Virtual tape libraries are becoming very popular. Again, it's still in a backup format, so it looks like tape. It's virtual tape, hence the name. But we're seeing a lot of that, and it changes it, you know, from a media of being a plastic tape cartridge, DLT, LTO cartridge, to a more virtual cartridge. It's definitely becoming more prevalent out there.
That changes.
VTLs have been there for a long, long time. They're nothing new. The thing about VTLs, basically, you can stack multiple virtual tapes on one physical tape, so it saves you space, it saves you cost, but it's not new technology. But tape, they've been talking about getting rid of tape for as long as I can remember. I don't see it going away. Discs are still not fast enough. They're still not cost-effective enough. They've just released these 2-terabyte discs, and the early adopters are having horrible problems. So tape is going to be here a while, I think.
Well, this is where I think we're going to end up parting ways, opinion-wise, because I agree with Quinn that people have long predicted the demise of tape, and that people are gone before the tape's gone. But the fact of the matter is, we have finally seen, if you look at the marketplace, we have finally seen a downturn in the use of tape. A lot of the formats that were prevalent before have disappeared. Pretty much everything is settled on what's called the LTO format, and we're seeing tape disappear. Arrays, the very high density and the lower cost of disk has finally knocked tape off its pedestal. Tape will now move, in my opinion, towards more of a long-term durable storage medium and is going to play relatively little role in disaster recovery.
Okay, and I have one last question here. And originally, I'd analogize this to going into the bowels of where things are, but where the backup tapes are and learning. But I'd rather change it in light of the friendlier metaphors we've thrown out into a field trip. Taking, when I was at that Georgetown conference, we've mentioned a couple of times, Quinn, one of the corporate participants talked about taking a trip into their e-discovery process and readiness process and looking at where the information was stored and where it was backed up. I think they had some slides in place for what they did at that company. So for the in-house attorneys or other people who oversee e-discovery or possibly records management, what do you gain from making this field trip into the backup procedures at a company?
It's a trip you've got to take. When you have a legal matter involving technology, it's really impractical for the in-house attorneys to have an immediate and full grasp of the complexities of the data management from an IT perspective. For this reason, it's really important that efforts are made to bridge the gap to ensure that technology decisions that have been made are explained in English so that all parties have a working understanding of the macro workings and why certain high-level decisions were made and what the consequences are. So in terms of how long are records kept for, what is defined as a record, what are the types of tape library you have, and so on. So if you're litigation prone and you don't have this picture in place, you've got some problems potentially. So if you don't have the in-house skills, then it makes sense to hire an outside consultant who does this for a living. And their role is to really come in as an outsider and to look at all the moving parts and to paint a picture and to talk about the technology and the processes and to prepare documents that, again, are in English that can be used for a meet and confer. This way, when the subject of tape is raised, everyone's comfortable with the overall mechanisms. And you can now talk about costs and risks and time frames. And as appropriate, you can raise proportionality or reasonable arguments with some real backing to those arguments because you've done your homework. So doing this field trip, yes, it needs to happen. And whether you do it yourself or you hire someone to do it for you or you get one of your IT guys who's comfortable with talking both legal and IT and can bridge that gap. If you've got that sort of person, then you really need to go down this path. It will save you a lot of time and a lot of pain.
Great. Well, I want to thank Craig, Quinn, Jim, all of you guys. Thank you for joining this ESI Byte show. It's, I think, been very helpful to turn this often discussed, seldom understood field into English, and I found it very interesting. To our listeners, thank you for listening to our show. For a complete list of ESI Byte shows, visit www.esibytes.com. It's easy to remember. A friend of mine told me, Easy Bytes. It's just like it's spelled, ESI Bytes. Remember what we all say here. You should visit ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov. Thanks again, and have a nice day.